I understand that, I realize that you've been at the University of Wisconsin for quite a long time. Was it 1946 you came?
I came back in 1946, January 1946, to become an assistant professor in journalism. However, I first came to the University of Wisconsin as a graduate student in 1939 at Syracuse University, where I did my undergraduate work. I became close friend of, student of, Fred Merwin. Fred Merwin, incidentally, is the uncle of Crawford Young, who was here on the faculty now. Fred Merwin had gotten his PhD with John Goss, political science department here, and Fred encouraged me to go on and teach and come here and study under John Goss. This is the best advice, I suppose, I've ever had in my life, because when I came to Wisconsin in September 1939 as a teaching assistant in the School of Journalism, and incidentally, our life is influenced often by very small things. Northwestern University offered me a $500 teaching assistantship, and Wisconsin offered me a $600 teaching assistantship, so I came to Wisconsin. I came primarily to study with John Goss, who was the greatest teacher I ever had. My whole intellectual life exploded when I came here in September 1939, taking courses with John Goss, Salih Perlman, Ed Witte, and other stimulating men. Opened up a world I had never known before. But I had to cut short my graduate work in 1941 because of the war situation and need to pay off accumulated debts. So I took a job for a year with the State Road Commission in West Virginia before going into the service. As the war was nearing its end, I got a letter from Professor Grant Hyde, the director of the School of Journalism, asking me if I would be interested in coming back to Wisconsin to teach. I certainly was, because long, boring hours I had to reflect on such matters in the South Pacific. I decided that Madison was the one place I wanted to live and spend my life. So I came back in January 1946 as an assistant professor in the School of Journalism.
Now, I'd like to hear a little bit more about the School of Journalism, but before that, I know that you were almost once, or maybe a year later, made assistant to the president. It was then Edwin Fred.
I think we can perhaps best proceed almost chronologically. I came back in January 1946, an assistant professor, and was joined by another young assistant professor, Bert Hoadley. The School of Journalism faculty had been reduced during the war, and we were swamped with loads of students. In the summer of 1946, Professor Robert Neal, under whom I had served as a teaching assistant, was now teaching at the University of Missouri, wanted me to come to the University of Missouri. And in the course of my negotiations with the University of Missouri, I persuaded Dean Mark Ingram to help strengthen the school by offering a position to Professor Henry Ladd Smith. And this was my extent of my bargaining with Professor Ingram, was to get him to agree to try to get Henry Ladd Smith back here on the faculty and to reduce School of Journalism teaching load to 8 hours because of the inordinate paper grading load that we had. Both of these things were accomplished. I'll come back to Professor Smith later. Early in 1947, President Fred, who had been concerned about building, renewing public confidence in the university, a public of confidence and support that had been frayed in the Frank and Dykstra years, became more and more concerned with the university's public relations. He was prodded into action in this regard by the oncoming centennial of the university, and also by a number of incidents with involving the press, which created a bad impression. In these things all tie together. In early in 1946, the U.S. Army, acting on the basis of a recommendation made by Arthur Page, started sending military officers with an aptitude for public relations to universities for graduate degrees in journalism and public relations. The University of Wisconsin and the University of Missouri both selected on the basis of reputations achieved in the past but not warranted at that present, were chosen to, as institutions to train, educate military officers for public relations. The first three officers in that program, which is just now petering out, came in the summer of 46, and one of these was a Lieutenant Colonel Chester V. Clifton, known more popularly as Ted Clifton. Ted Clifton was in my seminar, and I invited Andrew Hopkins, who was a tower of strength in the Department of Ag Journalism, Ag Extension editor, and a powerful figure on the campus, to talk to my seminar. And in the course of that seminar, he became quite impressed with Ted Clifton's intellectual capacity and alertness. And during this period, subsequently developed that Andrew Hopkins had been consulting with E.B. Fred about what to do about the university's public relations organization and proper observance of the bicentennial. So Hopkins recommended President Fred that Ted Clifton be utilized to draft a centennial celebration plan. Now, Ted Clifton later went on to become a distinguished military officer, Major General, was chief senior military aide and public relations advisor to President Kennedy and to senior military aide to President Johnson. Played a very key role in the revival of the Army's public reputation and strength in the late 50s and early 60s. Well, Ted Clifton drafted a centennial plan which included taking steps to improve relationships with the state's press. Well, then, early May, Professor Hyde came back from President Fred's office and said, President Fred wants you to take charge of the university's public relations, at least for the centennial year. And he wants you to go to work when classes are over in late May. And I said, there's no way that I can do that. Vernon and I had been planning to get married on May 21st, the day after classes were over. And we had not let anybody know about it. We were keeping it secret because we just didn't want a lot of fuss around the school. Erna was secretary in political science. Incidentally, I got not only my education from John Goss, I got my wife from John Goss. He introduced us. Hyde went back and said that, that was the first time he knew I was going to get married. Went back and told President Fred that I just was not available in May or through the summer. Well, Ern and I got married, went on our honeymoon, came back, and I took summer session that summer. And nothing more was heard about it. And that was a very hot summer, the summer of 47. And on a hot July night, we were up on Observatory Hill trying to cool off and enjoy the beautiful view of Lake Mendota when President Mrs. Fred came along. And he stopped to chat, and he said, "I thought you were coming in to see me." I said, "I didn't understand that I was coming to see you." He said, "Well, I want to talk to you." So I went in the next day, and he told me his concerns. His immediate concerns were he'd been through a very unfortunate press incident earlier in the year when pills compounded in the Department of Pharmacy had been resulted, gotten the wrong bottle and resulted in the death of a child at Sparta Colony. And they foolishly tried to protect the pharmacy school by suppressing it. Eventually the story came out. And also Professor Kiekhofer, who was chairman of the Centennial Committee, was pressing Dr. Fred to get a publicity program going for the centennial. I learned subsequently that President Fred was quite dissatisfied with the work of Robert Foss, who was then director of the News Service, or News Bureau as it was known then. And I want to be very fair to Bob Foss. This university has never had a more dedicated or loyal servant than Bob Foss. And he, in a very real sense, destroyed his health during the war by trying to handle the university's publicity and public relations, by handling the sports publicity. And he was almost a one-man band through that war period. And wore himself out. So President Fred then asked me if I wanted to become his assistant for public relations, and I did. And he gave me two assignments. One was to reorganize the university's public relations setup, and the other to organize the publicity program for the centennial.
Which would have been for 49, right?
Yeah, 48-49. And as several of us remarked during the course of that year, it's fortunate you only have to live through one centennial. But President Fred had a deeper purpose in mind, and usually his deeper purposes were always held close to the vest, and that was to build renewed public interest in public support for the University of Wisconsin. I think one of his great contributions was to greatly increase the understanding of and support for this university during his 13 years as president. But Bill Sarles, who was then his assistant, I talked to him about it, and Bill says, "Scott, keep your teaching position in the School of Journalism. You may not like university administration. particularly you may not like the fact you can't always go out and play golf on Saturday afternoon or Sunday morning when you're working for E.P. Fred. So I did. I continued to teach my public relations course in the School of Journalism the 2 years I served President Fred as his assistant.
So you remained a member of the department?
Yes. So when the budget was adopted in August of 1947, I was appointed assistant to the president for public relations and promoted to associate professor. Very amusing incident, which I think will on footnote of history. On Monday morning, August, whatever it was, I think 17th, maybe it was August 19th, 47, I was in President Fred's office. Monday morning after the adoption of the budget on Saturday, trying to discussing the outlines of our work. When President Burge, then his 90s, came in, he was really irate because he'd found in the budget that he'd only been granted one research assistant when he'd asked for two. He said, "Damn it, Edwin, I need two research assistants because I want to complete this project. I'm not going to live forever." He was in his early 90s at that point. So then I might say that Clay Schoenfeld, a former student of mine, had done a survey for me in a seminar that spring on the number of offices on the university campus that were issuing publicity releases that had full-time people involved, and it was more than 20. So one of my first moves was to try to bring some coordination to the dissemination of information from the university, and we did reduce the flow of releases and did reduce the number of offices issuing releases. And this led to a reorganization of the University News Service, the Sports News Service, and Agricultural Home Economics News Service. Now, Andrew Hopkins was a giant of a man, morally, intellectually, as well as physically. And he didn't take the coordination very well. He maintained the autonomy and independence of the College of Agriculture and the Home Economics, School of Home Economics. But Arthur Lentz, who was then director of the Sports Publicity, we changed the title to Sports News Service, was a very able and imaginative public relations person, later went on to head the U.S. Olympic Committee. Incidentally, I think that here's another historical footnote that ought to be in the record. Our much used and much admired symbol of Bucky Badger was an Arthur Lentz creation.
How was it?
Yes. Bucky Badger was created to meet a public relations problem when Wisconsin's athletic fortunes were at rock bottom. At the end of the 48 season, President Fred and the athletic board realized that there had to be a change in the head football coach, and Stuhldreher stepped aside as football coach and remained as athletic director. And Ivy Williamson was then hired to be head football coach and brought in a whole new staff. Well, for the homecoming of 49, Arthur Lentz saw the need for a symbol that would get the Badger up off his belly. And he worked with an artist whose name escapes me. And they created, using a figure of a raccoon, not a badger, they created a plucky badger with his jaw stuck out and his chest puffed out. This was a fighting, up on his feet, badger. And working with William Saxon, who was chairman of Homecoming, member of the crew, they made Plucky Badger, they had a big original prepared for the university bookstore. And if Arthur Lentz had copyrighted Plucky Badger, he would have died a rich man, but he wasn't inclined to try to profit from that creation.
It's all over now on t-shirts and goodness knows
that's
what.
That's right. But Plucky Badger was a symbol, public relations symbol, created to meet a public relations problem in our football fortunes and fan morale were at low ebb. But then one of the recommendations Ted Clifton had made to the president was to reorganize the news service. And so I started looking for candidates and wound up with the selection of Robert Taylor, who was then news director of WIBA. And I brought Bob Taylor in to be my assistant for the news service. And a year later moved him in as director of the news service and eased Bob Foss aside.
Did he retire at this point?
No, he didn't retire. He never retired when he died. He retired just a few years ago and died recently. I think he did. Yeah. Then, to handle the centennial publicity, I recruited Clay Schoenfeld, persuaded him to leave the Alumni Association, take on the job of handling centennial publicity and working with Professor Kiekhofer, which was no easy task. Professor Kiekhofer was very exacting in his demands and in his instructions. He was always terribly concerned that this would turn into a publicity circus and not be a dignified academic celebration. And Clay and I had our problems with Professor Kiekhofer and some of his committee, particularly Professor Knapp.
He was on the committee too.
Yes. Two, we in effect, Clay and I in effect abandoned two projects that we had planned and budgeted for the centennial. One was a radio series dramatizing the history and accomplishments of the University of Wisconsin. Another was a movie. Professor Kiekhofer was insistent, as were other members of the committee, insistent on having the scripts for this radio series and the film reviewed by the committee. And being convinced you cannot have creative work done by the committee, we just rather than submit to that kind of critical review, rewriting, abandoned those two projects. Then one of the first things I did to help reestablish rapport with the press of the state, which was one of President Fred's goals, was to set up a series of fall conferences, one for weekly newspaper editors, one for daily newspaper editors, and one for radio managers and news directors, radio station managers and news directors. I did some my fact finding and found that the weeklies and the dailies simply did not want to meet together. They felt they had different interests in. Over the years in Wisconsin, the weekly organization and the daily organization had gone their separate ways. In fact, and they made it clear to me, they did not want a joint meeting. That would not work. In fact, Bob Taylor, in the late 50s or early 60s, did try a joint meeting, and it didn't go over very well. Now, it's interesting to note, in this year of 1975, the two organizations have merged as...
At long last.
At long last. But I set up a weekly newspaper conference, a daily newspaper conference, and a radio conference, in which we invited the top people of these media to come to the campus for a day and a half. Provided a president's luncheon for them and a dinner, and then of course the attraction of the football game on Saturday afternoon. The first year, got a large number of the faculty and administrators to meet with them, to have lunch with them, to have dinner with them, and we discussed the university's policies and problems in a very frank, cooperative way. And these were most productive, and they were repeated the second year and have continued down through the years.
They're still going?
The fall newspaper conference is still going. It died there toward the end of the Fred administration, and then they were revived by Elvin and Harrington. I'm not certain, Donna, there was a lapse there, and I think it was toward the end of the Fred administration, and maybe during the Elvin years. I'm not certain. Bob Taylor would have to tell you that. Because when I went back to teaching, full-time teaching, the fall of 1949, Bob Taylor took over in my place as assistant president.
I see.
In retrospect, over my years here at Wisconsin, I now think that E.B. Fred was the ablest president we've had in my time here. I was not always persuaded of that at the time I was working for him.
You find him difficult to work with?
President Fred is, in one sense, a very difficult man to work for. In another sense, he is a very fine man to work for. He was difficult in that he played everything close to his vest, confided little, and gave you little explicit direction. He did everything by innuendo and indirection. Now, President Fred always gave the untutored observer, and I was untutored for a long time until I got to know him, the impression of a man who was fumbling, who didn't know where he was going, didn't know what he wanted to accomplish. President Fred always knew what he wanted to do and how he wanted to do it, but he believed that you had to make haste slowly. One time he told me, he says, "You're just like Al Peterson. You think that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line." And another time he told me, he said, "You know, you've never learned to walk around a brush fire instead of plowing through it." But he was a cautious man, and he was unsure of himself on the platform. He, in way, he was a paradox as a speaker. He was not an effective speaker. Yet his sincerity and his dedication came through in a way that did make him, his presence felt, his appearance effective, even though he fumbled around with speeches that were written for him. Incidentally, there again, it was very difficult to write speeches for him.
Did you do this?
Yes, I did. And I did the bulk of the speech writing the 2 years I was there. And that Clay Sheenfeld helped some, and Bob Taylor helped some, but I did most of the speeches during the 2 years that I worked for him. One time we kept a log on his speeches, and he usually went through about 7 drafts.
Oh my.
He wanted them to be polished and precise, yet not to say anything of real substance. He fussed more about the way things were said than what was said. About all he gave you in the way of direction for speech writing was he had a folder in his drawer that he dropped speeches that he was sent, and he would underline them in red pencil. And when he had a new speech to give, he would hand you his bunch of pamphlets or newspaper clippings or whatever that he'd underlined, so you could get some ideas here. But he didn't give you much direction, and he didn't want you to be too definitive and too precise on anything that would invite controversy. President Fred dreaded controversy, and he was sensitive to criticism. He was a very cautious, timid man on the public stage. He much preferred to operate from the wings. President Fred greatly enjoyed the presidency and the power that he carried to implant and impose his ideas of research and education. Yet he didn't enjoy the perquisites of office the way many men who seek those positions do. He didn't care greatly for entertaining, which was one of the reasons why he never moved into the president's house. Also, he was mindful of the cost of entertaining, I think. He never enjoyed the public spotlight, but he greatly enjoyed the politics off the public stage. Vice President Baldwin once told me that for years, President Fred ran the American Bacteriological Society, but the most uncomfortable year he had was the year he was president. And I'm sure Dr. Baldwin probably has suggested that this desire to operate without the public glare. And President Fred did not want publicity, did not seek publicity in effort to project the man in a way that would bring credit to the university. I several times publicized the fact that he didn't want to live in the president's house. Well, this created a problem because the terms of the trust under which that house was given required the president to live there. He said, you're getting me in trouble on that. Another time I publicized the fact that he had a Confederate flag, which his mother had given him, hanging in his home. And this later had brought us problems with the sons of the GAR, got us in trouble. But he did not seek publicity. In fact, the only time he took the initiative to initiate a story was one time when Floyd Andre, who had been his choice for Dean of the College of Agriculture, accepted the deanship of Iowa after he'd been turned down by the Regents here. President Fred Annis said he wanted to issue a statement what a great loss this was to the university, because he was still smarting because he did not get his way with the Regents and naming Andrea as Dean of the College of Agriculture when he moved Baldwin into the vice presidency. Professor Kivlin was able to develop enough support in the Regents to block Andrea appointment, and ultimately Dean Froker was selected as a compromise candidate. In all the time I knew President Fred, he only lost two battles with the Board of Regents, the Andrea appointment and a program for state scholarships. But let me say this, President Fred had a very difficult Board of Regents to work with. And he made that board look so much better in public than it behaved in private. President Fred understood, as some of his successors have not, that a president has to have two bases of power, his regents and his faculty. And these were his primary concerns, and he was a patient man, cautious man, and he worked tirelessly to achieve his objectives by informing, cajoling, flattering, consulting. And he spent an inordinate amount of time holding the hands of regents and trying to placate them and soothe their prejudices. And also he spent an infinite amount of time with the faculty. As I say earlier, President Fred always knew what he wanted to accomplish, but he moved very slowly and cautiously and to accomplish it. By the time he was ready to move, he had a consensus. And unless he had a consensus, he wouldn't bring something to the faculty, he wouldn't bring something to the Regents. Very early, because of he made a couple of miscues in handling the faculty meeting and got called for errors of parliamentary procedure. And I suggested to him, walking back to the office of the faculty, I said, "Dr. Fred, why don't you get one of the parliamentarians from the speech department to serve as parliamentarian?" He said, "Now, Scott, you can accomplish a lot more if you don't know the rules of Robert's Rules of Order." And this was really an indication of the way he worked. But to come back to speeches, in a way, it was very frustrating writing speeches for him, because once he got a draft, everybody who happened to be coming in the office that day would be asked to read it and criticize it. And quite frequently, Dean Ingram would come in, and Dean Ingram takes great pride in his writing, his prose, and he quite often would very severely edit manuscript that I or Clay or Bob had worked on. But this was one of President Fred's ways of consulting. When he had something on his mind, whoever happened to be coming to see him would be consulted on that matter. And as I say, we kept a log for a period of time there and found that typical Fred speech would go through about 7 drafts. Another characteristic about him were his cards. He had every known fact about the university on a pack of 3 or 5 note cards. And he carried these with him wherever he went. And they were designed to enable him to answer any questions about the university. Again, let me say, he was very unsure of himself on the platform because he was not an articulate, effective speaker. And he wouldn't appear in public without a manuscript. We even had to write out remarks for the Daisy Chain celebration up on Bascom Hill. Yet, I saw him trapped at least on two occasions where he had to speak extemporaneously. He did a very effective job. He just lacked any self-confidence. In many ways, President Fred was a very insecure man, which was strange in light of all his accomplishments and his abilities. But he was very nervous in public. And so he was difficult in that sense that he did not give you, say, now this is what I want to accomplish and here's the way I suggest you go about it. You had to pick it up by innuendo or indirection. And another thing, of course, were his hours. President Fred drove himself relentlessly. He worked till 5 o'clock, he'd go home, have supper, come back to the office, and work until he could get walk home and be there by 10 o'clock to hear the 10 o'clock news. He went to bed by the 10 o'clock news and got up for the 6 o'clock news, I think.
I've heard he was often in Bascom by 7.
Yes, and he worked Saturdays and Sundays. In fact, one of the reasons Bill Sarles left, some problem, some emergency came up on a Saturday afternoon, and he couldn't find Bill Sarles, and he later found Bill was playing golf, and he became very hurt at this. Bill, like I, thinks that a man has the title to play golf on Saturday afternoon. Very early when I was working for him one Sunday morning, he called me about 9:30. He said, "You gonna stay in bed all morning?" He said, "We got some problems up here." He was a kindly man, a warm, friendly man. And the only mean thing he ever said to me in the years I worked for him was, they created a state legislative council, and they wanted a report which was due early January. And Ern and I went to her father's home in Milwaukee for New Year's Eve. And Fred had told me he wanted me to work New Year's Day. Well, I got up the next morning and got back here about 10:30. New Year's Day, walking in feeling very noble, giving up New Year's Day to work on this memorandum. And he said, "They say down in my part of Virginia, a man won't work on New Year's Day as much count." I might say President Fred and I carried forth this good-natured banter over the years over the merits of Virginia versus West Virginia. I once reminded him that West Virginia had given the Confederacy its best general, and Traveller, the horse. He said, "Now wait a minute, I can tell you about Traveller." He said, "My uncle raised him and gave him to Robert E. Lee." He said, "No, he didn't give him to him. He sold him because Lee wouldn't accept it as a gift, the horse as a gift." Anyway, so in the sense of, because he had no family life, he never took into account the people around him who had family obligations. One of the very first dinner parties Ern and I had when we were living at Eagle Heights, he called about 7 o'clock with the sad news that Llewellyn Cole, who was handling public relations for the medical school, had died, and he wanted to come down and write a statement. So I left the dinner party and went down and wrote a statement. This was fairly typical, but he was just, he had nothing but his work. He had, other than his garden in the back of the house, he had no hobby that I know of.
He still has a garden.
Yes.
He grows tomatoes and says he doesn't like them.
But he was a very skillful political operator. And one of the reasons he was so skillful is because he didn't appear to be a politician. For example, Frank Sensenbrenner, aided and abetted by Faye Elwell, was determined to kill the school for workers. Which is one of Wisconsin's proud traditions and accomplishments. But this very conservative board, led by ultra-conservative Sensenbrenner, was determined to eliminate this school for workers.
Why did they want to do this?
Because school for workers trained union officials to be able and articulate in demanding pay and fringe benefits from management. So President Fred worked very quietly and cautiously with Edwin Witte and Nathan Feinsinger, and they came up with a protective shelter over the School for Workers, the Center for Industrial Relations. That was created as a shelter to house both the business management institutes and the School for Workers, which of course made clear that the university was there to service both business management and labor leadership. But that took a lot of time, a lot of negotiating, but he saved the School for Workers. In fact, I guess if you're evaluating President Fred's accomplishments, reestablishment of confidence in and support for the University of Wisconsin among the people of the state would be number one, and two, maintaining the university's academic freedom in the very difficult McCarthy years would be another. President Fred, by his conservative manner, ways, and thought, lent protective coloration to the university in that very difficult period. And maintenance of academic freedom in the 1950s was not easy. And that accomplishment I perhaps sometimes get overlooked.
Well, perhaps it's less emphasized here because McCarthy didn't actively attack the University of Wisconsin.
Well, that's because of the strength of President Fred and the strength of the university politically in that period, I think. One of the things I got greatest satisfaction from was staging the dedication of the Freedom Plaque. I tried to get it named, the Sifton Women Plaque.
And this is the one that was stolen?
Yes. That plaque was rededicated on February 15th, 1957.
56 or 57?
57.
I think.
Yeah.
Something we can
check. February 15, 1957. Well, that's a whole interesting story in itself. But I have sent the plaque disappeared homecoming eve. Turned out it was taken as a prank. And so there Board of Visitors and the Regents and others particularly the class of 1915, which had put up the plaque, were pressing President Fred very hard to do something. Well, of course, this is long after this is when I'm back in school of journalism. He called me up there, said, I've got this situation. We've got an investigation going, but we're dead end, and you can't dramatize every time you investigate something. But these people are pressing me, Judge Duffy and others are very irate. We're not doing anything to get that famous plaque back. So I said, why don't you and Bob Taylor talk and see what we can do about it? Well, we came up with the idea of a fundraising event to have it recast, because the Madison Brass Foundry still had the original cast. And we were all set to start the fundraising drive late that fall when Bob Taylor called me Sunday night and said they found the plaque out on Willow Drive. And so then the question became what to do about it. Now, you could take the plaque and have physical buildings and grounds, polish it, put it back up quietly, or you. So we decided to have a special event and rededicate the plaque, put it up in a way, in a manner in which it could no longer, could never be taken down again. And this was done, and I chose the date of February 15th, 1957, because this was the anniversary of President Fred's 12 years in office. Because, and Mark Ingerman, who was a staunch champion of academic freedom, former president of AAUP, presided. Helen White, who was then president of AAUP nationally, gave the main address. We had it in the Basket Theater because we weren't confident we could fill the Union Theater. And then we put the plaque back up and bolted through. And behind the plaque, there is a chest with the Curdy Carsonson history and history of the plaque. Other material.
Oh, really? Embedded in the wall?
Yes, behind that plaque is a history capsule, which was sealed on the stage by a university welder to give a little drama to the occasion. But that was a useful event in honoring Fred for his dedication to freedom, and it was useful in reminding the present generation of students and faculty, citizens of the state, how important that plaque has been in the history of this university. It's been this university's freedom has been always its great source of strength, and protecting that freedom from regents, super patriots, and others, Fred did very effectively, although he did it mostly in a quiet way. I'll give you one example of his shrewdness in handling these regents.